Session number 13265, reel number one.
Mr. Marsden, reel one. How and when did you come to join the Air Force, please?
In 1939, I was 18, and I attended an Empire Air Day air show at RAF Hucknall, where the RAF Volunteer Reserve people had a recruiting table. So I got an application form, took it home. I was then employed as an apprentice fitter at Plowright Colliery Engineers in Chesterfield.
Is Chesterfield your hometown?
Yes. Filled the paper in, took it to work, had it like the Territorial Army, the employers had to give approval because you were going to be asking for time off, possibly in the future. Got the approval, sent it back. That was in May. In August, I was called to Nottingham Town Centre, where I was formally enrolled, took the oath, that kind of thing, and went home again to await being called for training and so on. And then, of course, the balloon went up. And on September the 2nd, I shot off, did quite the wrong thing, as did quite a number of us. Quite a number of us went to RAF Hucknall instead of going to the town centre, which we should have done. And at Hucknall, there were two ferry battle squadrons in a turmoil being rushed off to France. And, of course, all we volunteers in civvies were being dumped on them. And that added to the panic. And we drew donkey's breakfasts, palliasses, you know, and all the gear. We didn't get uniforms, but we drew irons, knife, fork, spoon, all that sort of stuff, and went round, signed onto the station. And then somebody had the bright idea that all we volunteer reserve types should be hoofed off out of the way to the town centre. By this time it was about 1 o'clock, I suppose. We'd all had midday meal, and so we were piled into a truck. Oh, of course, first we had to hand the palliasses and the irons and everything back in, and that caused a fair amount of annoyance on the part of all NCOs who were busy enough doing other things. Anyway, we got to the town centre and we sat around in a waiting room, and there was an airman, LAC or some such thing, answering a telephone and writing lists and every now and again calling names and dishing out travel warrants and shooting people off to various RAF stations. About 4 o'clock, a group of us, five of us, were called out and we were sent off to RAF Scampton, 83 Squadron. We walked down to the railway station and found that the first train for Lincoln was around about 7 o'clock. So we sat and watched the traffic go by. I can still remember it. Quite exciting. There were transporters going by with tanks on and things of that order, you know, and everyone's thinking, cool, you know, this is really getting off to some sort of start. little did we know. Anyway, we got the train about 7 o'clock. It's about 30 miles, is it, from Nottingham to Lincoln, 30, 40. We got into Lincoln at 11:30. You don't need to say any more about that, do you? And we reported to the central police station there and asked for transport out to Scampton. And the sergeant there, he was in a fair old tiz as well, because he'd been loaded up, you see, with the classy reserve types and all sorts of folks coming in wanting information, wanting transport to units. And so he called up Scampton and they said there'd be a truck coming down. While we were waiting, a chap was brought in, stark naked apart from boots and socks. He'd been in one of the local pubs, might have been the George, it's a long time ago. And he got mixed up with a woman who'd taken him out on the canal bank where it was a proper badger game job. She'd got him out onto the canal bank and he'd letting him get started and so on. He'd had a few beers and then he'd get thumped on the back of the head and all his clothes stripped off and his documents and pay and money gone. And there's this poor character trying to account for himself and get himself to his unit, and he's not off to a very good start, is he? Anyway, that was that was for us the outbreak of war, which we all thought was fairly hilarious. And we got off to Scampton and were taken in the dark and put into a hut on the old what was then known as the recruit side of Scampton. I suppose that would be the First War, the Hutted Camp, dating back to about 1917. And there were beds in there with blankets and sheets and so on, so we just clambered in and got our heads down. Following morning, we're told to report to the station warrant officer after we'd got ourselves some breakfast. And there were dreadful warnings from all the airmen who were already in the hut, you know. Freddie Flaxen, he's a fierce character and so on. So we're all in some apprehension as we go hunting around the station with all the chits for getting everything signed up and entering on Freddie Flaxen first. Well, the instructions were vague enough. We found ourselves standing outside an open window, and I think I said, well, I'm dashed if I know where Freddie Flaxen's office is. And a voice came from the open through the open window from inside. This is Freddie Flaxen's office and I'm Freddie Flaxen, come in. And he turned out to be quite a fatherly type of bother. We learned later that station warrant officers, by and large, were chosen because of a considerable amount of character. They were not any old Tom, Dick and Harry NCO. To become a station warrant officer, you were a fairly considerable person. And he gave us our introductory lecture to the Air Force, if you like, since none of us had had... Well, I'd had no training in the VR, and I don't think any of the others had done any formal training. We were all more or less beginning, although the age range was, well, of course, I thought it considerable at that time. I was 18, and the oldest of us would be about 25. I mean, he was an old man. There were five of us. David Blackie was a Rolls Royce, probably still an apprentice, probably not 21 yet. And Lawrence Townsend was a mechanic working for a bus company in Hucknall. Eric, name's gone again. Anyway, one chap, Eric something or other, was an apprentice rigger at an airfield, a civilian airfield, where they were doing training flying for the RAF, just south of Nottingham. And Ronald Adams was from Mansfield, and I think he was a fitter of some sort, or an apprentice fitter. We were all near enough technical types. And we were allocated into 83 Squadron. I was in A flight. I think the others were in B flight, I'm not sure. Anyway, I was put onto an aircraft as a fitter to EUT. We were all classed as fitter to E's engine under training. Are you well clued up with the Air Force?
Well, I know a certain amount, but a fitter to E is a bit new to me.
Ah, well, there were trades in the Air Force in those days. Group 1 trades, fitter 1, which was a comprehensive trade, without going into great detail, fitter 1 was engines and airframes, and quite often one or two other things as well. And you pretty well had, in those days too, you pretty well had to be a fitter 1 to become a sergeant in the Group 1 trades. Fitter 2s were fitters engine, fitters airframes, instruments or whatever, you see, single trade. And then that was Group 1. Starting pay was 3 and 6 months a day, possibly slightly less than it had been in 1918, but certainly no more. In fact, the service pay rates were give or take the 10% cut which caused the Invergordon mutiny and things like that, were the same as they had been in 18. Group 2 trades were flight mechanics airframe, flight mechanics engines, flight mechanics armourers and things of that sort. There were fitter armourers and armourers Group 2, and electricians and instrument bashers, instrument repairers, instrument makers and so on. And then you go down through various groups 3, 4 and 5. Groups 3 and 4 were a whole load of ancillary trades, clerks and all the other station headquarters people and so on, the background crowd, and down to Group 5, which were unskilled aircraft hands, ACHs, and commonly called ACHGD, aircraft hands general duties. And they could be put anywhere, and where they might pick up some of the trades people's work and help out with it and so on, but were not allowed to sign for anything. To sign for work done on an aircraft, you had to be a recognised trade. And having signed for it, of course, you carried the can for it. Well, so there we are. Now, we are fitter to E's UT, U stroke T, under training, which means that we are not allowed to sign for anything, but we are allowed to do things to assist the fitters and the flight mechanics. And being allocated to an aircraft ground crew, we begin to learn the aeroplanes. The aeroplanes were Hamptons. And incidentally, the aircraft to which I was allocated was quite often flown by Gibson. I was on AOL, which I think it was, might have been 4049, L4049, I can't remember that exactly. It's not greatly relevant. Snaith was the CO. Snaith had been in the Schneider Trophy, in the Schneider race team years earlier. And that was that so far. On the Sunday night, the aircraft were, on Sunday afternoon, the aircraft were bombed up, and they took off on an operational flight. Took off at about 7 o'clock in the evening, thereabouts, 7 or 8 o'clock. And it was it's now known as an armed reconnaissance in the history books. They were under orders not to drop bombs on any shore installations, but they could bomb German shipping. We didn't know that at the time. The air crew did, of course, but we didn't. And they all came back with their bombs because, of course, they didn't find any German naval forces at sea. Whether they'd have been allowed to bomb German civilian shipping, I don't know. Probably not, the way things were in that funny war. And that happened for the next two or three nights. And then there was a kind of panic on. It was suddenly thought that the Germans were going to plaster us left, right and centre, and so our aircraft were sent away on dispersal to Ringway. And that lasted a few nights. They came back, and then there was a period of bombing up and debombing, and they didn't go anywhere. It was a very confused period indeed. During that time, I can remember being on the aircraft. By that time I'd been taught how to run up and do various things, so I was doing probably most of the things that the average flight mechanic was allowed to do, refueling and taking cowlings off and inspecting the engines in the course of a normal daily inspection, that kind of thing. And I was on the aircraft working when a flight sergeant armourer came along, and a sergeant armourer, and a corporal armourer, and an LAC armourer, quite a procession of them, and hauling a bomb trolley with a 2,000-pounder AP bomb on it. Nice, long, golden-coloured bomb, in that yellow colour that the bombs were in those days. And the trolley, as I recall, was one of those with the lattice-type jack on it, so that the bomb could be jacked up, with an expanding trellis-type arrangement. And they got it under the aircraft and offered it up, installed the bomb carrier and offered the bomb up and then lowered it down again. And then they got out a manual and started fusing the bomb according to the book. The flight sergeant read the book, and the sergeant did something, and I left, because to me, I'm a rather cautious type, and it was quite obvious that they'd never dealt with one of these bombs before, didn't know exactly what they were doing, were dealing with them by the book, and I always had the idea that in those circumstances, the fewer people present, the better. So I wandered off somewhere else until they finished. And on that occasion, everything went quite well, I suppose. Because, there were no nasty noises. That led me to doubt whether the RAF was really as prepared as it ought to have been. And the next interesting incident occurred when it was decided that the airfield had to be enlarged, and we'd spent some time digging a trench around the new perimeter to take telephone cables, and on the old perimeter the airfield is on the edge of what is known in Lincoln as the cliff, and the cliff is an escarpment facing south, and in the if you look south across the airfield, then in the right hand corner along the cliff in the next field, which was soon to be part of the airfield, stood an old farmhouse, quite an old stone farmhouse, probably early 18th century, I guess. We had used that as a guard room when we'd been on guard around that side of the field, but that was due to be demolished. And someone had the bright idea that it would be a good idea for 49 Squadron and 83 Squadron to do low-level practice bombing on this. There had recently been cases of low-level bombing in the North Sea by our aircraft using where the bombs had fallen, hit the water or the target ship, promptly exploded and blown the tails off the kites as they passed over at 40-50 feet. And so an 11-second delay fuse had been introduced, and this was an opportunity to try it out. The fuse was fitted into 250 and 500 pound dummy bombs as a smoke puff, so that when you drop the bomb you could see the white smoke puff to check that the fuse was in fact working. And it was decided that the aircraft would approach from Lincoln, from the east, along here, make their run on here and bomb from 50 feet. All very simple. It was left to the bomb aimers as to how they would manage the bombing. The ordinary RAF bomb sight was useless for that kind of thing. It hadn't been designed for that kind of work. Well, some of them measured the distance off from maps and so on, scaled it off, and with a stopwatch calculated the bomb dropping time from this first boundary or some suitable marker point. One of them, a chap in our squadron, it might have been somebody, his name may have been Greenwood or something of that order, a big chap, he made a bomb sight using a couple of pieces of wood and a couple of nails, and set it up so that when the nails lined up on the house, that was his target point. I suppose he crafted a little bit of geometry and so on, scaled it all off, did his calculations on bomb drop time from 50 feet at the aircraft speed and so on. And I reckon that one was very... Gibson knew about it. It may even have been in Gibbo's kite. It was something like that which they tried out when they were doing their practice development work for the dams at later in the war. You'll find mention in the literature of this firewood bomb site. Anyway, they all worked out the way in which they were going to bomb, and on the day we were told to keep clear of the farmhouse. So we are down here on our... these were aircraft dispersals up to this time, just grass, but so we were watching here, and we notice into this field over here, along here on this line, a whole stack of Humber staff cars and so on, and they lined up here. We looked at each other and wondered, because as we could see that these people were all going to be absolutely in line with the line of flight, which has interesting connotations if you think about it. And out of these staff cars get all the top brass from group and bomber command and so on, and they stood here to watch the aircraft coming along towards them and bombing. Well, of course, when you drop bombs from 50 feet, if you drop them fractionally early, as Nelson found out, you play ducks and drakes, don't you? And the bombs bounced and came over the farmhouse and went skittling into the cars. And all this top brass, the people who are supposed to run bomber command, who had no more sense than to stand in the line of flight of these bombs, had to take to their heels. And we all began to wonder if this was going to be another 1914-18 job, with the whole show being run by twits, because it seemed awfully like it.
Was anybody killed?
I don't think so. No, they were smart enough to get moving a bit sharpish when they saw what was happening. But it was discouraging, let's put it that way. Well, I can't... there's not really very much more to say about events at... Oh, yes, there was another interesting one. In those days, the RAF still had a squadron of Virginias, Vickers Virginias, an aircraft which was not so very dissimilar to the Vimy's of the First War, you know. These aircraft, the ones that were left, were used for parachute testing. You may have seen photographs of the Hendon air displays where men stood on the outer wings of these aircraft on a little platform and allowed themselves to be pulled off by a parachute. Well, the RAF used weighted dummies for testing parachutes. And the dummy, this was a male dummy figure in flying suit and everything. They were rigged up on these outer platforms with the parachutes and a length of kite cord, cod line, running from the ripcord on the parachute, the D-ring, into the aircraft. And when they were ready to test that parachute, chap in the aircraft pulled parachute opened, and pulled the dummy off. That was the theory. When you pulled the cord, the dummy, it was so rigged that the cord holding the dummy to the strut was also released. Well, the Virginia was an incredibly slow aeroplane. You could actually, in a nice breeze, you could land Virginias backwards. And Virginia pilots used to take great fun in flying backwards across an aerodrome when they get a wind. So it was quite an interesting aeroplane in many ways. We all thought it hilarious. This Virginia landed up by the hangars, and it was going to do parachute testing the following day. And in order to park it, the pilot took off, flew across the aerodrome, and landed at the other side. Without going, you know, within the aerodrome, within the field, which we thought was hilarious. Anyway, comes the day, and they get loaded up, the parachute section all abuzz, takes off, flies round, comes over the airfield, probably doing all of 45, 50 miles an hour. First dummy is released. The dummy used to have a name. It may have been Major Henry. Can't remember that. But it was well known. And cords pulled, dummy came off. No parachute. Parachute didn't open, The dummy just came hurtling down, thud, in the middle of the field. And there was a deathly hush. Of course, everyone on station was watching this performance, and see this thing, the first effort, and no parachute didn't work, was again slightly discouraging. It wouldn't have done anything for the aircrew, I don't think, because in those days parachutes were objects of considerable veneration, as we found out the following year when we were on hurricanes. Anyway, you are aware, are you, that the English are we are the greatest myth makers in the world.
I'd begun to wonder.
Yeah. We create myths about anything. I suppose it goes back to Saxons and so on, who were pretty good at it. A couple of other little interesting ones. You know the panics about spies and guards and things in those days, beginning of the war. We all had to do guard duty, and although I thought it was ridiculous, on the full side of an airfield, you know, take a large airfield as a square, there would be one guard on duty, guarding, say, eight Hamptons, the full length of the field, eight Hampton aircraft, and one man with a rifle and. Possibly five rounds, or possibly not, it depends.